Our subject here is the second part of Hume's essay of miracles. That second part consists of paragraphs 14 through 41, and those of you who bothered to download the little file that I posted will be able to follow along by paragraph number there in most of these cases, perhaps all. I think I've given the exact location in Hume. If I haven't, you'll easily find any that I've missed. I gave you earlier a preliminary outline of what Hume covers in Of Miracles Part 2, and I want to go back to that because he has four principal lines of argument, and we're going to consider each of them in turn. His argument in Part 2 is that miracles are never, in fact, as well supported as they might be because of one or another of these problems. First, the witnesses are never sufficiently sensible, educated, sincere, and prestigious. Second, human beings tend to set aside critical thinking when considering miracle reports. Third, miracle stories tend to circulate among the ignorant and barbarous. And fourth, every religion has miracle stories and prodigies, and these cross-cancel one another. And then Hume tries to give some examples of this phenomenon. So let's look at the argument from inauspicious conditions. We can find this in paragraph 15 of the essay. Here's how Hume puts it. There is not to be found in all history any miracle attested by a sufficient number of men of such unquestioned good sense, education, and learning as to secure us against all delusion in themselves, of such undoubted integrity as to place them beyond all suspicion of any design to deceive others, of such credit and reputation in the eyes of mankind as to have a great deal to lose in case of their being detected in any falsehood, and, at the same time, attesting facts performed in such a public manner and in so celebrated a part of the world as to render the detection unavoidable, all which circumstances are requisite to give us a full assurance in the testimony of men. That's a lot of requirements, and some of you may be thinking already of a passage in Sherlock's Trial of the Witnesses where Mr. B points out that really it doesn't take a great deal of learning and ingenuity to tell the difference between a living body and a dead one. But I think one of the fullest answers to this is actually an anticipation. In 1744, Samuel Chandler had already covered this objection 4 years before the publication of Hume's Philosophical Essays, and he had covered it with reference to Peter Annett's attack on Sherlock's trial. So here's what Chandler, defending Sherlock, had to say. All the characters of integrity appear in these writers that can possibly be demanded or desired. The very inconsistencies that at first view they seem to be chargeable with show at least there was no contrivance amongst them to deceive others. They make no scruple to tell us that the first appearances of Christ were to a few women, with whose single testimony they well knew the world would be far from being satisfied. They seem to have concealed no circumstances of Christ's appearances, however exceptionable they might possibly be in some men's opinion and judgment. They plainly assure us that the disciples imagined the first accounts of the resurrection to be mere dreams and tales, and unsupported imaginations, and were not the least disposed to receive or credit them. It doth not appear that they could have any present interests to answer by the accounts they gave, if they had not known them to be true, or that they were set on to write them by persons who either could reward them or receive themselves any worldly advantages from the publication of those accounts to others. That last phrase in Chandler is a very interesting one, that last bit about not having been set on to write them by persons who could reward them or receive any worldly advantages from the publication of them. Because I think here, Chandler has in mind something that he doesn't bring out explicitly. There is a Life of Apollonius written by Philostratus early in the 3rd century. Apollonius is supposed to have died at the end of the 1st century, so the writing is more than 100 years after the death of the individual he's writing about. And it was used by some of the early anti-Christian writers, like Hierocles, as a counterpoise to the Christian miracles. Well, you have your miracle accounts, we have those of Apollonius, according to Philostratus. So this appeal to Apollonius's miracles, which are in many cases very suspiciously similar to things that we read of in the New Testament. I could go into a long discussion of that if anyone were interested. Seems to be something that at first has at least some plausibility. However, Philostratus was asked to write this by the Empress Julia Domna. So it was specifically commissioned by the wealthy and powerful for the sake of renewing belief in ancient pagan deities and of displacing Christianity, which at that time was encroaching on an ever larger segment of the Roman Empire. So that would answer the description that Chandler gives here, which he says did not apply to the writers of the Gospels. Hume's second argument is an argument from the passions of surprise and wonder. Here's a statement of that. Men are the more easily imposed on in such matters as they love to gratify the passion of admiration and take a great deal of pleasure in hearing or telling of wonders. Once again, this is not Hume. This is someone who predates Hume. This is from Thomas Morgan's Moral Philosopher, a work I did not make you read, though it is in the database from 1739. Hume picks up on Morgan's line of argument here and expands on it in his own way. But to understand how Hume goes about this, it's necessary to take a step back into the 17th century and read a paragraph from the fourth book of John Locke's Essay Concerning Human Understanding. This one's headed One Case Where Contrary Experience Lessens Not the Testimony. And here's what Locke says about it. Though the common experience and the ordinary course of things have justly a mighty influence on the minds of men to make them give or refuse credit to anything proposed to their belief, yet there is one case wherein the strangeness of the fact lessens not the assent to a fair testimony given of it. For where such supernatural events are suitable to ends aimed at by him who has the power to change the course of nature, there, under such circumstances, that may be the fitter to procure belief, by how much the more they are beyond or contrary to ordinary observation. This is the proper case of miracles, which, well attested, do not only find credit themselves, but give it also to other truths which need such confirmation. Locke's syntax here is complicated, but the point that he's making can, I think, be stated rather simply. In most cases, we take the fact that an event is of a type seldom seen as counting against it, as something that requires us to bring greater evidence in order to underwrite serious belief. But in the case of miracles, that's not true. And the reason that it's not true is that miracles are just what we should expect if God is endorsing some messenger or some teaching, and therefore that normal rule that the more improbable antecedently the event, the more evidence we require, is broken. Now, watch how Hume, in his statement of this objection, makes, I think, veiled reference to what Locke has in view. Here's Hume from paragraph 16 of the essay. We readily reject any fact which is unusual and incredible in an ordinary degree, yet, in advancing farther, the mind observes not always the same rule. But when anything is affirmed utterly absurd and miraculous, notice the way that he's pairing absurdity and miraculousness there, the mind rather the more readily admits of such a fact, upon account of that very circumstance which ought to destroy all its authority. The passion of surprise and wonder arising from miracles being an agreeable emotion gives a sensible tendency towards the belief of those events from which it is derived. And this goes so far that even those who cannot enjoy this pleasure immediately, nor can believe those miraculous events of which they are informed, yet love to partake of the satisfaction at second hand or by rebound, and place a pride and delight in exciting the admiration of others. So it's pleasurable to be the relater of an incredible tale, and it's pleasurable to relate it even at second hand, because people love to listen to these things. And so our tendency to give credibility to things that really, because they're so outlandish, should be absolutely incredible, overrides the principle by which we govern our reason in every other case. Several of Hume's antagonists jumped on this particular aspect of it. They said, look, nothing is more out of the course of our experience than what Jonathan Swift recounts in Gulliver's Travels. So if Hume's principle were correct, everyone should take Swift's satire as a piece of historical reportage, but no one does. We all know that it's just a story. So where is the effect of this passion of surprise and wonder in relating the absurd, the never before heard of? That's just not true. We don't in fact act that way. It sounds good as a piece of rhetoric, but that's not the way that we actually engage in reasoning on these matters. Hume's not done, however. He has a second string to his bow. If the spirit of religion join itself to the love of wonder, there is an end of common sense, and human testimony in these circumstances loses all pretensions to authority. A religionist may be an enthusiast and imagine he sees what has no reality. He may know his narrative to be false and yet persevere in it with the best intentions of the world for the sake of promoting so holy a cause. Or, even where this delusion has not place, vanity excited by so strong a temptation operates on him more powerfully than on the rest of mankind in any other circumstances, and self-interest with equal force. What's the objection here? Well, who wouldn't like to be seen as an emissary from heaven? This is something that every human being would be subject to as a temptation. And in a religious context, this temptation must be the strongest of all. George Campbell, in his dissertation on miracles, takes quite a bit of time dismantling this objection. And here's the way that he starts off. He says, the prejudice resulting from the religious affection may just as readily obstruct as promote our faith in a religious miracle. What things are in nature are more contrary than one religion is to another religion. They are just as contrary as light and darkness, truth and error. The affections with which they are contemplated by the same person are just as opposite as desire and aversion, love and hatred. The same religious zeal which gives the mind of a Christian a propensity to the belief of a miracle in support of Christianity will inspire him with an aversion from the belief of a miracle in support of Mohammedanism. The same principle which will make him acquiesce in evidence less than sufficient in one case will make him require evidence more than sufficient in the other. That the evidence arising from miracles performed in proof of a doctrine disbelieved and consequently hated before did in fact surmount that obstacle and conquer all the opposition arising thence is a very strong presumption in favor of that evidence, just as strong a presumption in its favor as it would have been against it had all their former zeal and principles and prejudices cooperated with the evidence, whatever it was, in gaining an entire assent. In other words, religious propensity cuts both ways. Yes, it tends to make people accept more readily things that are in favor of their already existing beliefs and prejudices, but it also tends to make them much more resistant to anything that tells against their established religion. If you don't believe this, I suggest as an experiment that you travel to Mecca and try to start a new religion there. You'll be dead before you hit baggage claim. That is not something that the devout Muslims are going to accept. You're not even allowed into the city unless you're a Muslim, and attempting to promote a new religion there would be, let's just say, the height of unwisdom. So the question then arises with respect to any miracle claim, was it proclaimed in a place where the people surrounding were friends or where they were enemies? Where they were inclined to accept without examination, or where they were inclined to dismiss except on the force of the strongest evidence. But Hume's got a third argument. Here's a statement of it. It is very observable that the more ignorant and barbarous any people remain, you shall find them most abound with tales of this nature. But again, this is not Hume. John Toland had already put this forward in Christianity Not Mysterious. So Hume is very much borrowing the arguments of the deists as he proceeds in this fashion. Here's Hume's version of it from paragraph 20. It forms a strong presumption against all supernatural and miraculous relations that they are observed chiefly to abound among ignorant and barbarous nations, or, if a civilized people has ever given admission to any of them, that people will be found to have received them from ignorant and barbarous ancestors who transmitted them with that inviolable sanctity and authority which always attend received opinions. So Hume is counting on his Protestant readers to accept what he says because they reject Catholic reports of miracles in ecclesiastical history, even relatively recent ecclesiastical history, perhaps those surrounding the lives of some of the saints. He counts, that is, on his Protestants being cessationists and therefore already half inclined to grant the point that he's trying to make. Once again, George Campbell has a direct rejoinder to this. If ignorance and barbarism are the conditions in which miracle reports flourish, then he says, what pity was it that Muhammad had not a counselor so deeply versed in human nature as the essayist who could have assured him that there needed but effrontery and enterprise, that with these auxiliaries he had reason to hope the most impudent pretenses would be crowned with success. In other words, if ignorance and barbarism were such advantages for putting over a miracle account, then why didn't Muhammad risk pretending to perform such a miracle? And the answer is perfectly obvious. He feared that if the cheat was discovered, and it might well be, his cause would be discredited. Anyone who engineers a fake miracle for his cause is looked upon with at least as much disfavor as people who forge their scientific data. We've heard cases of scientists committing suicide after it was discovered that they fabricated data. How much the worse would the case be for someone who fabricated a religious miracle and then was caught in the act? So Muhammad frankly refuses to perform any miracle. And again, as you read the Quran, people say to him, perform us a miracle. What work do you do to show us this? And he says, you had a chance to see miracles with other prophets. I'm not here to perform a miracle. The only thing you're going to get is the miraculous literary beauty of the Quran itself. Try to write a chapter like it, and if you can't, then confess that it's a miracle itself. But you're not going to get anything else. Now, the appeal to literary taste, as opposed to the evidence of the senses, is quite a different appeal. And the sort of miracle that Muhammad was willing to appeal to, where he would himself no doubt be the judge of the adequacy of their copying a chapter of the Quran, seems to be a very slender basis for substantiating his claims. But that is all throughout the Quran that we get. So Campbell's point is that if ignorance and barbarism made it so easy, then why wasn't this tried by those who lived in ignorant and barbarous times and places? Adams more directly speaks with respect to the fundamental claims of Christianity. This religion, he says, did not get strength in the dark and then adventure itself by degrees into the light. It was openly proclaimed from the first in the temple and in the synagogue where the Jews always resorted. And when the apostles had filled Jerusalem and Judea with their doctrines, Rome and Athens were some of the next scenes of their ministry. So, as Paul says in Acts 26 in his defense before Agrippa, these things were not done in a corner. And Hume's suggestion that the first reports were merely of something peddled off to ignorant and barbarous people is actually a misdescription of the circumstances. Finally, we come to Hume's fourth argument, and the one that he gives quite a lot of time to. Here's the way he sets it up. In matters of religion, whatever is different is contrary, and it is impossible that the religions of ancient Rome, Turkey, Siam, and China should all of them be established on any solid foundation. Every miracle, therefore, pretended to have been wrought in any of these religions, and all of them abound in miracles, as its direct scope is to establish the particular system to which it is attributed, so has it the same force, though more indirectly, to overthrow every other system. In destroying a rival system, it likewise destroys the credit of those miracles on which that system was established, so that all of the prodigies of different religions are to be regarded as contrary facts, and the evidences of those prodigies, whether weak or strong, as opposite to each other. So there's a sort of grand cross-cancellation going on. The miracle stories are put forward by all of these different religions, and they all cancel one another out, leaving us where we began. That is to say, with no miraculous evidence whatsoever for any of them. Now, there's an assumption that Hume makes here, and that is that the role of miracles in all religions is the same. In particular, he's assuming that all religions are supported by miracle claims at their founding. But as several of his critics point out, that is simply not true. Miracles, as opposed to portents, things that are natural phenomena that we think perhaps have some deeper significance, like a really bad storm coming in before you set out to war, things that are not merely matters of interpretation, but are actually sensible productions of things beyond the productive power of nature, events that nature alone could not bring about, are not regularly propounded at the founding of all religions. In fact, quite the contrary, they're very rare in that capacity. It's much more common to see them appealed to after the religion has got started and got well on its way. So here's a general rejoinder, and I'm giving it in two versions, one from Adams and one from Campbell. Adams wrote first. Adams says, there is a wide difference betwixt establishing false miracles by the help of a false religion, that is, a false religion already in place, and establishing a false religion, at its first instance, by the help of false miracles. Nothing is more easy than the former of these, or more difficult than the latter. Campbell pursuing a similar line of argument. There is the greatest disparity in this respect, a disparity which deserves to be particularly attended to betwixt the evidence of miracles performed in proof of a religion to be established, and in contradiction to opinions generally received, and the evidence of miracles performed in support of a religion already established, and in confirmation of opinions generally received. Hume goes on to give three instances. These are instances of his own choosing. He wants to discuss the cures attributed to Vespasian, Cardinal de Retz's story of the man with a miraculously healed leg, and the cures reported at the tomb of the Abbey Paris. But before we get into these, it's interesting to notice what he doesn't discuss, and that is the central Christian claim of the resurrection of Jesus. This omission did not go undetected, but probably the most forceful way of drawing this out is what Peter Bain says. Bain quotes Hume's maxim. You'll remember from the end of part one, no testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle unless the testimony be of such a kind that its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact which it endeavors to establish. When anyone tells me that he saw a dead man restored to life, I immediately consider with myself whether it be more probable that this person should either deceive or be deceived, or the fact which he relates should really have happened. I weigh the one miracle against the other, and according to the superiority which I discover, I pronounce my decision and always reject the greater miracle. If the falsehood of his testimony would be more miraculous than the event which he relates, then, and not till then, can he pretend to command my belief or opinion. And then Bain says, exactly. No statement could be more reasonable. Let us proceed, then, to that comparison. The Christian has to produce testimony to miracle, whose falsehood would be a mightier wonder than the miracle attested, and Hume has to weigh miracle against miracle. What was the next step to be taken in Hume's argument? What did his own statement require him to do? Clearly, to take up the miracles which Christians allege to be true, to set their evidence fully and distinctly forth, and to point out that however plausible that evidence might be, its fallaciousness would be no miracle compared with the miracle it affirmed. This, I say, is what the law on the case as laid down by Hume required. This is what, in his own court of evidence, Hume prescribed. But every reader of Hume's essay knows that he has done nothing of the sort. The nature of the evidence required for the Christian miracles, once fairly stated, those miracles are quietly put by him out of court. The trial proceeds by proxy. Hume does not ask what proof is offered that the Christian miracles took place. He calls to the bar certain miracles with which Christianity has nothing to do, enters upon their evidence, condemns them as falsities, and then calmly informs the court that the Christian miracles are disproven. Vespasian, according to Tacitus, performed two miraculous cures. The Cardinal de Retz mentions a miracle of the reality of which he was assured, and sundry prodigies are said to have taken place at the grave of the Abbey Paris. These last, Hume informs us, might with some appearance of reason be said to surpass in evidence and authority the miracles of the Saviour. But it is really too much to ask us to take his judgment in such a case. Our folly would be unexampled and inconceivable if we did not insist on putting aside his instances of miracle and claiming what he has himself accorded us, the right to select a crucial instance of our own. I think Bain has a point. But pursuing only a case which Hume does not directly discuss would still leave the nagging question as to whether he had a point in these other instances. Therefore, most of the earlier respondents, and Bain is writing in the middle of the 19th century, most of the earlier respondents to Hume actually did engage quite directly with his three cures. So let's go through them briefly. Here's Hume. One of the best attested miracles in all profane history is that which Tacitus reports of Vespasian, who cured a blind man in Alexandria by means of his spittle. Some of you may recall a comparable passage in the Gospels. And a lame man by the mere touch of his foot, in obedience to a vision of the god Serapis, who had enjoined them to have recourse to the emperor for these miraculous cures. In other words, these two men came to petition that the emperor would heal them and said, hey, you know, we were in the temple of Serapis, and Serapis said, oh, go appeal to the emperor and he will help you. The story may be seen in that fine historian, Tacitus, where every circumstance seems to add weight to the testimony and might be displayed at large with all the force of argument and eloquence if anyone were now concerned to enforce the evidence of that exploded and idolatrous superstition. The gravity, solidity, age, and probity of so great an emperor, who, though through the whole course of his life, conversed in a familiar manner with his friends and courtiers, and never affected any of those extraordinary airs of divinity assumed by Alexander and Demetrius. The historian, Tacitus, a contemporary writer noted for candor and veracity, and withal the greatest and most penetrating genius, perhaps, of all antiquity, and so free from any tendency to credulity, that he even lies under the contrary imputation of atheism and profaneness. The persons, from whose authority he related the miracle, of established character for judgment and veracity, as we may well presume, eyewitnesses of the fact, and confirming their testimony after the Flavian family was despoiled of the empire and could no longer give any reward as the price of a lie, to which, if we add the public nature of the facts as related, it will appear that no evidence can well be supposed stronger for so gross and so palpable a falsehood. There's much to be said about this particular instance. One of the things that was pointed out immediately by Hume's first critics is that if you read in Tacitus a little bit more widely than what Hume has related, you'll discover that when the men made this appeal to Vespasian, Vespasian had some doctors check them out, and the doctors came back and reported that the blind man was not wholly blind, and the lame man was not completely lame, which circumstance itself is at least curious. They also told him that he ought to go ahead and try it, and if it failed, then they would just denounce these two plebeians as cheats, and if it succeeded, it would be of benefit both to him and to the local deity, Serapis, because Alexandria was a city where the Christians had been making some inroads as well. And as we know from Pliny the Younger, for example, the governor of Bithynia, wherever Christianity took root, it tended to diminish the revenues at the temples of the local gods. So Hume's critics tore into this one. Campbell, for example, points out regarding Vespasian, no emperor showed a stronger inclination to corroborate his title by the sanction of the gods than the prince of whom he is speaking. This doubtless he thought the more necessary in his case, as he, Vespasian, was of an obscure family and nowise related to any of his predecessors. How fond he was of pleading visions and presages and auguries in his favor, all the world knows. If you will read up about Vespasian in Suetonius, you will find that Campbell speaks nothing less than the sober truth here. I might add that Vespasian was not the emperor at this point, but he had just announced his aspirations to become emperor. This is in a very troubled period in Roman history in the mid-60s, the middle of the first century. And Alexandria was the first major city to come out in favor of his imperial aspirations. So everything conspired together here. a man who wishes to be emperor, a miracle that redounds to his favor and in favor of the local deity at the same time. It's a win-win situation. Now, how about all of Hume's encomiums to the genius and gravity and solidity of Tacitus? Well, Campbell says that would all be to the point if Tacitus were trying to tell us on his own recognizance that this is true. But doth Tacitus pretend that he was himself a witness of the miracle? No. Doth he mention it as a thing which he believes? No. Is it fair to plead the veracity, the truthfulness of the writer in proof of every popular rumor mentioned by him? The question is a rhetorical one. No, clearly it's not, and so what Hume was doing there is just a rhetorical flourish and has nothing to do with the argument. Let's move to Hume's second example. The doorkeeper of the cathedral in Saragossa had been seen for so long a time wanting a leg, but recovered that limb by the rubbing of holy oil upon the stump, and the cardinal assures us that he saw him with two legs. This miracle was vouched by all the canons of the church, and the whole company in town were appealed to for a confirmation of the fact, whom the cardinal found by their zealous devotion to be thorough believers of the miracle. That's the way that it reads in the third and following editions of Hume's essay, but in the first and second editions, he says rather more. He says when the cardinal examined it, he found it to be a true natural leg like the other. I was so curious about why he had changed it that I actually went hunting through De Retz's works, found copies of them, and didn't rest until I tracked it down, and all that he says is, I saw him with two. There is no description of his going down on his knees to roll up the guy's pant leg and feel to see whether it's a wooden or a natural leg. Nothing of the sort whatsoever. Merely, I saw him with two. John Douglas, the author of The Criterion, one of the respondents to Hume within Hume's lifetime, although this quotation is taken from the fourth edition, says, there's a principle for allowable suspicion with regard to a reported miracle. It runs like this. We may still suspect them to be false if in the time when and at the place where they took their rise, the circumstances were such that they might be suffered to pass without examination. For if the circumstances under which the miracles were appeared to be such as that we can give a probable account of their passing current without examination, we shall be warranted to conclude that this really was the case. In other words, Douglas is saying we are not obliged to take with full seriousness a report of a miracle done in a place and under circumstances where even if it were false, there's no reason to think that anyone would say so. In a case where it falls in with all of the local prejudices and the local beliefs, the evidence is less. Now, that does not mean that the thing did not happen. It does mean, however, there is a ground, and a fairly serious ground, for doubt. And it's obvious that in this case, in Saragossa, in Spain, this would have been something that the entire population would have been predisposed to accept without particular inquiry. And so, for that reason, Douglas's criterion comes in and says, there is a specific reason to doubt this. But of course, the parallel claim would not be true with regard to the early Christian proclamation of the resurrection, which took place in Jerusalem, where there was a strong faction opposed to it. In fact, so strongly opposed that people like Saul of Tarsus were commissioned to haul people off to prison and bring them up to try to get them killed for their beliefs. How about the cures at the tomb of the Abbey Paris? The curing of the sick, giving hearing to the deaf, and sight to the blind, says Hume, were everywhere talked of as the usual effects of that holy sepulchre. What holy sepulchre? Well, there was a fight in France between the Jesuit faction and the Jansenist faction. You may have heard of Blaise Pascal. He was one of the more famous advocates of the Jansenist position. And the Abbey Paris was a Jansenist. Their public struggles against the Jesuits were turning against them, and then the Abbey Paris died, and at his tomb suddenly people began having convulsions, and there were cures reported, so much so that eventually the entire sepulchre was fenced off, and people were forbidden to come there because it was so notorious a place for the Jansenists to claim that miracles had taken place. Voltaire reports that some wit coming upon the fenced-off area put up a little placard on the outside of it that said, "By order of the king, God is forbidden to do miracles in this place." An amusing piece. I rather hope that's true, actually, although with Voltaire, you never know. But what is more extraordinary, Hume goes on, many of the miracles were immediately proved upon the spot before judges of unquestioned integrity, attested by witnesses of credit and distinction, in a learned age and on the most eminent theater that is now in the world. Nor is this all. A relation of them was published and dispersed everywhere, nor were the Jesuits, though a learned body, supported by the civil magistrate and determined enemies to those opinions in whose favor the miracles were said to have been wrought, ever able distinctly to refute or detect them. There's the claim. Is it true? Well, Campbell and Adams and Douglas go over this one with a fine-tooth comb. And they say Hume, following his one source, is misrepresenting the facts. So, the Sieur Lidol was supposed to have been miraculously cured, but he later wrote a letter to the Bishop of Lyon saying, I was at a Jansenist convent, and I was somewhat ill, but I was not near death, and they pressed a confessor of the sacraments on me, and that sort of blew the whole thing out of proportion. It was not really that serious. I was sick, but I was not dying, so it was not a miraculous cure. This he himself wrote in a letter. The widow de Lorme said that she had been smitten with palsy because she had gone to the tomb of the abbey with intent to ridicule, and this was her punishment. Well, she herself expressly confessed that she had faked it, that actually that wasn't her purpose in going to the tomb, and that it was all just a put-up job. Anne Lefranc, who was said to have been cured of a disorder in her eyes and some other things, turned out never to have had anything wrong with them. There were some notarized certificates to her cure, but the people who signed those certificates were shown them later, and they all said these were tampered with after we signed them. This isn't what we signed. Things have been added to this after our signing. Hume changed some things in later editions of the essay, and this is a place where he did take some notice of some of his critics. So he inserts a lengthy footnote into the second edition claiming that many of the miracles were, and here are his words, proved immediately by witnesses before the officiality or bishop's court at Paris, under the eye of a cardinal whose character for integrity and capacity was never challenged even by his enemies. So you've got a cardinal on the side of the Jesuits who could not help acknowledging the truth of these things. Is that so? Actually, the only signatories to the petition were the 22 curés who had presented it to the cardinal, and he rejected the petition on the grounds of palpable falsehoods proved upon the witnesses by juridical information. So this entire claim is undermined by the actual facts. I have a copy of a book in French that goes into this entire thing in great detail. It's a two-volume work, and I am slowly translating what bits of it I can and looking for someone who's fluent in French to take up the slack. So if that's you, let me know. In the same footnote, Hume claims that the cardinal's successor, though he was pressed to examine these miracles, wisely forbore. Well, it was Charles Gaspard de Ventimille who succeeded the cardinal, and he ordered a public juridical inquest into the miracles, published the results. We have the ordonnance, as Adams describes it, from November 8th of 1735, containing, quote, convincing proofs that the miracles so strongly warranted by these curés were forged and counterfeited. So, again, Hume is just misrepresenting the facts in the case, and he was caught and called out on it by his contemporaries. This is one of the reasons why Adams' response went through three editions. He had to keep up with all the changes Hume was making and the different claims he was making and the footnotes that he was inserting. With all of that before us, and indeed with the entire course before us, I think it would be a good idea to sum up the view of the Orthodox with respect to the entire controversy. So here's Leland's summary, and certainly nobody took greater pains to survey the entire ground than Leland did. Considering how many writers have appeared in this cause within this century past, and what liberty they have had to propose their reasons and their objections, it can hardly be supposed that they have left anything unattempted that had the face of argument by which they thought they could answer their end. And, therefore, if it appears, as I hope it does, upon the view which hath been taken of them, that their most plausible objections have been solidly answered, it is to be hoped that their attempts, however ill-intended, will turn to the advantage of the Christian cause, as it will then appear how little its enemies have been able to say against it, considered in its original purity, even where they have had the utmost freedom of proposing their sentiments. They have appealed to the bar of reason. The advocates for Christianity have followed them to that bar and have fairly shown that the evidences of a revealed religion are such as approve themselves to impartial reason, and, if taken together, are fully sufficient to satisfy an honest and unprejudiced mind. That is the end of the last lecture that we have.